Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. The Let's Get Busy podcast is produced in part by All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com. Welcome to Let's Get Busy, a weekly podcast where I talk shop and get down to business with authors, illustrators, award winners, up-and-comers, and everyone in between. I'm Matthew Winner. And before I get started, I wanted to say hi, a shout out, a thank you to all of the great people I met at KidLitCon this weekend. It was such an amazing time to be in Baltimore with people that blog and write and are active in the KidLit community. It was wonderful to be all in the same place. And I'm looking forward to all the amazing librarians I'm going to meet this Friday at MASL, at the Maryland Association of School Libraries conference in Linthicum. That's my home state. I'm excited to be around my people. It should be a really wonderful time. I look forward to seeing all of you. Well, let's get right to it. This is episode number 197 of the podcast with K.A. Holt, author of House Arrest, which is published by Chronicle Books. This is Carrie's second time on the podcast, and I didn't waste a minute getting to dissecting her process when it comes to writing novels in verse. What she revealed was absolutely brilliant, and it's a mental image I think will come to mind when I think of her books from here on out. I hope you have an amazing time listening to this chat. Here is episode number 197 of the podcast with K.A. Holt. Let's get busy. Welcome back to the Let's Get Busy podcast. Carrie Ann Holt, I am honored to welcome you back.
I am so excited to be back.
My resident poet friend, I'm so excited. I have had poets on the podcast since you, but none that are writing novels in verse, none that I can't even tell you how excited I was today to get to talk to you, just because, well, as I was saying prior to recording the podcast, I know you now, and so I know that I get to just sort of catch up with you, but also to ask, like, tell me more about this life as a poet kind of thing. Welcome back, and congratulations on the release when this comes out. So will your book. Congratulations on the release of House Arrest.
Thank you so much.
Buddy, your new book, it's good. It's like, it's really good. It's going to be, I'm just going to warn listeners up front, it's going to be hard to stay out of, like, potential spoiler territory area. It's a little gray for me on how far we should go, but I think we'll both sort of guide each other through it. But sure. I know the safest way for me to go is just to ask you right now, just to share with the listening audience what House Arrest is all about.
Sure. So House Arrest is about a boy named Timothy. And Timothy is kind of having a rough go of it. Obviously, he has been arrested and he is underneath this house arrest, which is basically he's got kind of a year of probation. He was arrested for stealing a wallet. He was caught pretty quickly. And he really initially in the beginning of the book doesn't feel any guilt for stealing this wallet. And the reason why he doesn't is because he was using the money to buy medication for his little brother who is very sick. And his mother is a single parent. His father has left. And Timothy just wants to do everything that he can to help his mom out. And so the book is in journal form. He has a court-ordered psychologist, and she's requiring him to keep this journal. And he also has a probation officer. And so the book is Timothy writing to the both of them in this journal. And we kind of see him struggling with this sort of what's right and what's wrong, the black and white and gray, and figuring out, you know, when it's okay to do wrong things that might be right or right things that might be wrong. And it's just Timothy's struggle with his circumstances and trying to make good out of bad things, I guess.
I think that's a perfect summary. And I love that, as I recall, last time we talked, you were even sharing that when would a boy write in a journal when it's a court-ordered thing
when
to
do?
He's forced to do it. And I think you play with that voice really well in this story, that it is revealed over time but it's revealed that the reason, as you said, that Timothy committed this crime was out of a necessity to take care of his brother, who that relationship Timothy has with Levi is so touching, Carrie-Anne. Oh my word. There were moments that I stopped and read things aloud to my wife just to say, listen to this. Isn't this beautiful? And she promptly picked up the book and read it faster than I did, which is wonderful. I am a person that deliberates over words. So we are two different readers in the house. And I think that means we get two different experiences, which is a wonderful thing. Anyway, I digress. I loved seeing this way that you're able to have Timothy talk to everyone in his life, but specifically to his parole officer, sometimes so flippantly, and then immediately in the next journal entry, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said it that way.
That's right. He's getting in trouble with these things, even when he's writing them down.
Yeah. Even the moments when it's I can tell that you're writing, or I can tell that you're reading over my shoulder, and let me, you know, defy you by just writing it down anyway. You just had such a fully realized character in Timothy, and to have that voice consistent and to have the reason why he continues to write. And even there's a moment in the story when he isn't forced to write, but continues to do so out of the habit and out of what the journal has come to mean to him, was something that I thought was pulled off really effectively.
Oh, thank you. I worked hard to do that. I wanted him to be very reluctant to write in this journal, and that thinking it was the stupidest thing ever. And then as he found his own voice, you know, and discovered that these things that he couldn't find words for to talk about in, you know, face to face with somebody, that he could write it out. And I wanted to see that progression. I wanted the audience to see his progression, you know, as he figured these things out.
Well, there's so many different things that he there's so many different things that he is figuring out during this time that I feel like, okay, so I'm just gonna call it what it is. I realize that you're an author, Carrie-Anne, but there were moments in this story when it felt like I was reading an actual journal. I was like, no, remember when Timothy did this thing and then this really happened in his life? But I realize that that is silly. So let me just admit it publicly in case there are children listening that can know that that happens to adults as well. But for example, between James, his parole officer, and Mrs. B, the psychologist, the observations that Timothy makes, in their relationship, the observations that Timothy makes in his best friend Jose's relationship with him, and what it means when he starts having feelings for Jose's sister, which happens early on, but it is played with and drawn out over quite a long amount of time. To have that insight into a boy's mind, I found something like that to just be something that I feel like this is, I think of my boys that are going to read this book, and I think about how many books are out there that give a chance for them to journal their feelings, or maybe even more so talk out their feelings. And talk out, what does it mean to have these unusual or strange feelings and not sort of know how to deal with them? Right. And in that way, too, you're your book is maybe even on some level giving them permission to just write out your feelings and know that that's an okay thing to do and a safe place to just explore how you're feeling in a place like that.
Yeah, and that it's okay to even have feelings, you know, that these crazy things that you feel, it's fine. And that there's other kids out there who, even if nobody's talking about it, you know, everybody has these same feelings. I think that's a really important thing to understand when you're a kid, that you're not alone.
Oh my word. How important is that to know that you're not alone? And isn't that where good books do their job of helping a child feel not so alone or to experience things to help feel empathy for others?
Absolutely. And I was, and you know, when I was writing this, I was thinking like, I will probably be hard pressed to find a reader, in the same kind of circumstance who has a very sick little brother or whatever. But I wanted it to be something that felt universal. You know, everybody has tough things in their lives. Something is happening that you might not want to talk about or that might just feel like too much, you know, and I wanted them to be able to see that with Timothy, even if it's not the exact same circumstance that you're, you know, you're having these empathetic, familiar feelings and that you're definitely not alone.
One of the things that I saw, or one of the things that spoke to me, the universal feeling, was a feeling of pride and how when we are struggling, especially when our families are struggling with things, it can feel shameful to be going through this. To, for example, in the case of Timothy's family, to be in a position where you potentially are going to ask your community for support, for financial support in this case. With their, is it the Carnival of Giving, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Right.
To be comfortable enough with that, that you're able to, well, there's that point when Timothy is back and forth about whether or not to do this and also considering, well, what does this mean when flyers go out and my whole school sees it? What are they going to think of me or of my brother or, you know, what implications does that have? I think that that's something that, there's your universal feeling there that we all have something about our families that maybe not all of us, but many of us that we're hiding because I think of our pride. We don't want someone to judge us because of what we're going through with our family. I mean, I think you could make a strong argument that anyone that knows Timothy for the way that he cares for his little brother, Levi, would think him to be an exceptional human being, not just an exceptional young man. And yet, oh, it looks like it auto called you back.
Hey, you're back.
That was weird.
That was totally weird. It just cut right out.
Dropped call. Oh, well. It looks like everything's still recording. I'm sure it's a glip. Maybe it's the weather.
Maybe it's the rain.
Maybe it's the rain. Let me just jump back in.
Sure.
So I was talking about that point of pride and having to feel like it's okay to share with your friends, or it's okay for your friends to realize that you are this person that cares a lot about your brother. I think that I have kids in my school that their friends and their peer group don't understand things like that yet.
Right. And the idea, I think, that accepting help doesn't mean that you are admitting weakness, you know, that just because you say it's okay to help us doesn't mean you're saying that you're like weak or not able to handle things on your own. You know, of course you are needing help, but it doesn't mean that you are helpless, if that makes sense.
That does make sense. And I think that that's a hard relationship to play out for a child when their parents may be feeling that same way. I think Timothy's mom struggles because she wants to provide for her children, and she wants to be able to be the provider for her child. And I think that it's hard to be in a position where you have to ask, or maybe Timothy feels like his mom is afraid to ask for help.
Yeah, I think his mom has a harder time coming to that acceptance than Timothy does. Like, he finally just kind of hits a wall and is like, oh my gosh, we're going to have to do this, you know, because he has been making these plans to get help for his little brother. And he knows, you know, we can't do it alone. And his mother, it takes a little more convincing for her. She really, really wants to be able to do it. And she really, really doesn't want to have to ask for help. And he sees that and has to kind of combat against it a little bit.
Right. So in this story, Levi, he has a health condition that, judging by the note in the back of the book, it appears to me that you have firsthand experience, if not in your direct family, in friends of your family that have gone through something similar to Levi. Is that true?
That's true. This Levi is his condition is based on my youngest son, Isaac. And Isaac was born premature. And once he was out of the NICU, he was doing okay for a while and then just stopped breathing. There's a scene in the book with the mother chasing after the gurney with Levi on it, and he's not breathing, and they're trying to get him to the ICU. And that is a scene that's basically autobiographical. I mean, that exact same thing happened when my son was 5.5 months old. And he ended up with a tracheostomy, which is a tube in his neck so that he could breathe. He had a condition called subglottic stenosis, which meant that the tube, his trachea, just was not wide enough to get much air once he hit a certain weight. And we had a team of doctors in Cincinnati. They reconstructed his trachea when he was 2, and he's 7 now and absolutely fine. Everything's great. But it was a tough road for a long time with that kid, and I had to find a way, I think, to just get that all out, and imagining, you know, what that would have been like to have been an older sibling, you know, somebody watching his parents struggle with this, just made this book.
I can see that. And I can see too, how well tempered you were in sharing details and sprinkling those details throughout, when we see, Timothy need to, clean out Levi's trach tube, and, Timothy dealing with the nurse that comes into the house to take care of, his brother, and feeling like she is offering subpar, well, she is offering subpar, help, and what that means for what his role needs to be in order to defend and protect his brother.
Yes. Yes. I mean, there are a lot of this book is taken from experiences that we had. I mean, it's obviously not an autobiography. I mean, nobody stole a wallet. My husband and I stayed married, but it was really difficult. And we did, you know, we had some tough times with the nurses, and there was just, it's just a lot to be happening at once. And my oldest son at the time was not as old as Timothy. But I did wonder and try to talk to him a lot about just, you know, how he was feeling with strangers in the house all the time and with us having to be away and in the hospital. And I mean, that's a lot to process for anybody, but in particular, you know, an older brother.
Yeah, to have someone like that, you're right. To be older and therefore on some level to be processing it all, and just how scary that can be, that there's, you know, when there's a threat to your ability to breathe, to breathe in, then that can take a turn and get really bad, really, yeah, really fast. It's very tough. Scary.
It's life and death every day with a trach. It really is. And it really does turn. There's a scene in the book where it's Levi's first birthday and everybody's celebrating and they're laughing. And then all of a sudden he's not breathing. And you know, things like that happened all the time where you're just going about your normal everyday business. And then it's like, oh no, the baby's not breathing. So it's tough to figure out how to put that in a book, you know, so that kids can understand it and relate to it on some level, and also not have it be just completely terrifying or overly medical or whatever.
Well, there were these moments that stuck with me, that were very like sensory strong moments that I felt like this is going to be something like this is what's going to be sticking with the children that read this book as well. But when Levi's too, there's something that is happening. He's laughing or something that's causing mucus to come out of the hole. And to have that be something that is happening, and just to details like that, where it's, I never would have thought that. Or when Levi, there's a moment. Okay. There is a moment. This will not ruin it. Carrie Ann, I promise this will not ruin it. There's a moment when Levi talks.
Yes.
The way you wrote that scene, that, oh my word, I could feel you going through that. And this was before I even knew that you went through this. It was one of those moments that was written so truthfully that it felt like this author has to have some sort of deeper connection with her character or with the feeling of a breakthrough, that was such a beautiful moment in your story.
Thank you. Yes. That, I mean, we went through that with Isaac, and he was discovering that if he put his finger in his trach and basically blocked off all air, that he could push air through his vocal cords and make a noise, you know,
yeah.
Say things. And it was a miracle. I mean, we hadn't heard his voice since he was 5.5 months old. So it was a pretty amazing moment.
Oh man, that I'm thankful for you, Carrie Ann, for writing your life into this story, because it is something that I don't think every child will get to experience in their lifetime, but I think that it is something incredibly special to demonstrate the relationship that siblings can have and that friends in your life can have. I really thought just the whole role that Jose's family played in Timothy's life was something really wonderful too.
Yeah, like an extended family. Yes, we had a lot of that. We were very lucky when the wagons circled around us, when we finally allowed the wagons to circle around us, and to have friends who really did become part of the family. And, you know, it was almost like the kids having two moms and two dads and three moms and three dads, and just who could swoop in at any moment and help us and take them. And we would know that the kids would be safe and just fine, you know?
Right. If you don't mind, so I've folded over. I've done the thing that I tell my children to never, ever, ever do, which is that I dog-eared the heck out of this book. Because every time I read one of your poems, there were some that the language was just too incredible not to just stop and reread. But would you mind if I read an excerpt from... Gosh, should I read this far into? Yes, I can, because it doesn't give anything away. Would you mind if I read an excerpt from later into the book when the family is left in a situation where they need to make some tough decisions?
Sure,
is that okay?
Yeah.
So for those that are listening, if you want to jump to this, I'm on page 221. Says, Mom left fingerprints on my arms. I'm looking at them right now. Purple ovals on each bicep, one for every hour of sleep she's had in the past 4 days. All I said was, I won't let you do it. And she just flipped out. You think this is what I want? Her teeth were together so tight, the words were like quiet growls. You think any of this is part of a plan? Every day is a lava-riddled path, Timothy. Every day I have to choose a step and decide what hurts less. Which of a million terrible choices is the least terrible? My word, that is so vulnerable and amazing. And to have a moment where a mom or an adult in a child's life can have that moment of weakness in front of the child, where the child is is in some way, and Timothy is a 13-year-old in this story. Am I right? 13, right?
Yeah, he turns 13.
He turns 13 in it. Yeah, so this middle school age boy that there are moments when he needs to be strong for his family.
Right.
And he sees these glimpses of mom trying to keep it together and when it's okay for it to just be too hard. And I thought that and many other pieces were just so beautifully written and experienced through, especially through your format, because the concept of writing a novel in verse, it is mind-boggling to me. what it means to go back and edit, what it means to create line breaks because of the way that creates phrasing.
Right.
And monitors pace.
And emotion. There's so much you can do with a line break. It really is a tricky little thing.
I mean, really, where in the world do you start? I don't know if I asked you this last time. It doesn't matter. It's worth hearing again. When you approach writing a novel such as House Arrest, what is your process? Do you just start writing poems and sort of gathering and placing? Do you make a massive outline? How in the world do you approach a beast such as this?
Well, I have a little summary. So I basically know kind of what I need to have to happen in the beginning, middle, and end. But I don't do a very detailed outline as I first write. What I do is I get to know the character and I know there are things that have to happen. And so I write those poems first. And I put them in a document and I look at it and say, okay, well, you know, that's not enough. And those are all terrible. And I just kind of...
Those are all terrible. Here's my folder of terrible poems I've written.
Exactly. I create like a backbone for the book, I guess, kind of a skeleton. And so hopefully by the time the skeleton is created, I have a first draft that is guiding me through. And then I go through the first draft and these little things will sort of jump out at me that I want to be threads, you know, like in House Arrest, there's a lot of stuff about galaxies and stars and universes. And so after the first draft, I noticed that was popping up a little bit and that was becoming part of Timothy's voice. And so I will get a notebook out and I will write, you know, which page numbers those had showed up on to begin with and see if I need more, if I need to spread it out. And so as I'm writing, I'm discovering these different threads, and then I can write out of order. So it depends on my mood for that day. I'll say, well, people are going to need to know about the trach, and they're going to need to know what it's like to have a baby with the trach in the house. And so I wrote like a million poems about that, and then had to kind of cull it and figure out where it was all going to fit. And so it becomes almost like a quilt, like a puzzle, where you're putting together all these pieces, at least for me.
Yeah, for this particular book, because it is in these days, these journal entries. Granted, it's separated, it's labeled by weeks, but we have sort of these breakdowns of different entries. I should just put it that way. When you're saying you're exploring who your character is or you're writing around this topic, are you sort of writing as if here's my journal entry for the day and just sort of seeing what angle seems to work best or match an emotion? Are you Frankensteining some of these together to take the best of multiple poems? Or do you find that your writing works best in these sort of separate poems that end up working with one another?
I do. It's funny because when I write prose, it's very linear. I write it from the beginning to the end and the beginning to the end and the beginning to the end until I'm finished with the drafts. But with poetry, it's much less that way. And I will actually, like, I will literally print out the entire, what I have of the manuscript, lay it out on my floor in my living room, and I will put markers in my pocket and I will walk back and forth from all of the pages, marking down different like ideas and plot points and stuff. And so I will color code it so that when I stand back, I can see, there's not enough pink over here and there's too much green over there.
Really?
Yes. And then I can sit down.
Oh my word. That visual, Carrie-Anne, is amazing.
And that's when I know what I'm missing and what I need to write. And the mood, like the tone and Timothy's, just the way that he was feeling all kind of fell into it. Once I got that basic skeleton on my floor, then I could trace, you know, the arc of his character from the beginning to the end of the book based on the colors and how they were spreading out through the manuscript.
The way that you edit and construct your story is to literally lay it out on the floor and see it. I love that.
Yes, I am incredibly visual. I cannot use Scrivener to save my life. I have to, I have to print it and put it on the floor and like put the dog in another room and threaten the children and just have at it.
When you're marking the themes that you're talking about, are you the colors you're talking, just so I can get a little bit better sense, and for those that read it, this will end up making more sense too. But are you talking about like, well, here's all the times we are catching up with Timothy and his relationship with Issa, or here is when we're pursuing this thought on the Carnival of Giving. Is it sort of things like that focus?
Yeah, it is. Carnival of Giving had its own color, and like Jose and his father in the car,
yes,
the turtle
car, right?
That had its own color.
Just to make sure.
Stuff. Yeah, just because I wanted to make sure that everything is. That it's not too top heavy or bottom heavy, or that things don't fall out. Or if things do fall out, maybe it's for a reason and I should, you know, eliminate it from the beginning of the book or the end or whatever.
Well, okay, I'm sorry.
It's a really good way for me to visually see how the story is working, if that makes sense.
It does, because from my experience reading it, I could tell how intentional you were in bringing up different topics so that I didn't forget about them. We did keep coming back to the car, the turtle car.
Mm-hmm.
And we did keep coming back to different things, and it felt like you were allowing these things to just be almost, I don't know, these buoys in the water that sometimes they sink down, but then they come back up and other ones go down and then those come back up too. That nothing was introduced in the beginning and then just like on page 180, you're like, oh my goodness, I forgot to talk about this other thing again.
Right. And hopefully as you're reading it, it comes across organically like, you know, oh, well, she decided she had to put this plot point here 10 pages from where it was before.
Oh no. Could you imagine if I flipped like every 25th page and, oh, look, there's a mention of the
exactly.
Whatever. No, that would be, it actually felt like it was coming up the way that it comes up in your life, that as certain things were progressing forward, gosh, I can't talk about this book because there's stuff that I don't want to give away. This is so frustrating. It's so fun to have a book that you you like and want to talk about, but I need other friends to read it so we can talk about it, everybody.
Yeah, everybody read this book.
But there were unexpected things that moved forward, and when they moved forward, they started occurring more frequently, or when they needed to, they started occurring more frequently. My favorite plot line, I think, was Timothy finding out that there was a surgery. There was a doctor in the U.S. that could perform this surgery that could save his brother's life. And then how there were moments when Timothy was writing this doctor all the time. And then some other conflict happened in the family that had to take his attention for now.
Right, right. He lost focus. He had to lose focus.
Yeah. But then often by whatever thing was causing him to lose focus, he returned to that doctor with a different emotional charge that it was very obvious was affected by the events that just happened in between his correspondences with his doctor. And that I can see that the intentionality that you were orchestrating there, that was something that I really enjoyed. And I feel like, gosh, if I went back, as is almost easier for me to do because things are broken into, I don't know, separate poems. I don't want to say stanzas, but separate poems as it is, I could pull all of the letters that he wrote to that doctor and just look at them one after another and and reflect on, almost from a psychological standpoint, well, what was Timothy going through at this point? I mean, as a teacher, I feel like that's exactly what I would be doing in a book club and something like that. Well, let's reflect on where Timothy was in his life just by his writing, because as a teacher, I can do that in your writing too. I can see that there's days right. when there's something going on, because you're either really feeding me with these ideas, or sometimes you're giving me words that I feel like there must be something else going on in your head, because I have never heard you bring this up with me before.
And as an author, I mean, optimally, I'd like for you to be able to do that with each of these threads, where if you pulled them out and you put everything together, that was about the Carnival of Giving or all of the letters or all of the turtle car stuff, that you would be able to see his character arc, like through each of those individual things, like see how he was changing as he was reacting to these things. That's my goal, at least. Little books within a book, I guess.
Yeah, I like that idea of threads of little books, of almost like not short stories all blended into contributing to one bigger story, but in that way it is, that Timothy is an amalgamation of all these different threads going through his life, but yet we can see the same things played out in different aspects of his life, with the way he cares and is concerned for his brother and his family situation and whatever in the world is going on with school and what it means to report to a parole officer and what they're going to think when you're just like, hey, just so you know, I went over and was with Jose, and I know you're going to be mad, but we don't have any food, and so we had to do that.
Right.
I think that actually come across this with this conversation makes me want to go through and do that with a group of kids. Let's take this apart and see how it informs the character as well.
Yeah, it's just like real life. You know, you have so many things going on at one time and they all inform each other, and it just is sometimes just this whirlwind in your head, and you have to stop and compartmentalize a little bit. And I think Timothy does that sometimes.
Well, I think you have done an exceptional job weaving all of this together to create something that, as I said before, and I mean this sincerely, I felt like this could have been a found writing piece that you found in some juvie thing, that some boy had written this and you just got permission to copy it and share it with us. It felt, the phrase I always go to, and I'm sorry that this is like the phrase I go to with you, but that it just felt fully realized. It felt like it was believable and it came enough from your own experience or from your own research, and enough from Timothy's experience and you listening to him telling his own story. And I really, really like that. So I'm excited for other people reading this and the way that it's going to connect them with you, because I felt like this time around, there was just something about Timothy's experience in this story that made me feel like I was closer to you, Carrie Ann. And maybe I could just say up front that part of it, I think, was because I have a son, I have two children, with anaphylactic food allergies. And so this feeling of a life-threatening experience always, you know, at always potential in every situation
right, that
we're in.
Right, that ticking time bomb feeling.
That feeling. And also right. the feeling of how much I choose to show or hide from my friends, because I perhaps don't want to burden them with this, or perhaps don't think they'll understand, or don't want to leave myself to criticism from them, or whatever. There were just moments that I felt like I could really connect with Timothy and feel what he was going through. And that made me feel connected with you, because I felt like this is being written by a person that has walked in these shoes before. So thank you for your honesty on the page in this book.
You're welcome. And you know, I feel like I got so close with Timothy when I was writing this that I forget he's not real sometimes. And I will catch myself wondering, you know, what he's up to and what's going on in Timothy's life. And then I remember, like, wait a second, you made him up.
But come on, that's like the most amazing gift, isn't it? That your writing gave you that back.
Yeah. I forget that I made him up, which is crazy. That sounds crazy, but yes, it's true.
Before I let you go, I want to ask about what you've been working on and what potentially you're allowed to share that's coming out. But is there any thought at all to returning to Timothy's story?
You know, I haven't really talked about that with anyone at Chronicle. It would be something I would be interested in looking at, you know, I maybe like outlining or at least seeing if there would be another story there.
Right.
But it isn't something that I have planned.
Okay. Fair enough. What are you working on though? Or what is in the pipeline? If you can share anything.
I can. Well, I have something completely different that's coming out in February. That's a space Western.
A space Western?
Yes, it is not poetry. It's prose. And it was pitched as Firefly meets Little House on the Prairie.
Oh,
right, so
oh
man. It's this girl and her family, and they're very religious, and they live on this moon where the generations ago, there was a crash landing. They never made it to the planet they were supposed to get to. And so they're on this moon with this, with these native aliens. And it's a story about the natives versus the homesteaders, and the girls, this girl and her sister get kidnapped and are sort of brought into this life with these natives, and how she deals with it and how strong they make her feel and how conflicted she is about that. So there's that. It's called Red Moon Rising, and it's in February.
February?
Yes.
Holy cow, that's soon.
It's very soon, I know.
Oh my word. Is that Chronicle as well?
It is not. That's with McElderry, with Simon & Schuster.
Okay, that makes more sense. I was going to say two books with the same publisher within like months seems insane.
But with Chronicle, the book that I'm working on now is tentatively titled. I guess it's, I don't know if we're going to stick with it or not. I think we might. It's called Beyond the Rails.
Beyond the Rails, okay.
Yes, and it is another middle grade novel in verse. And this is about a boy and a little girl who live in Guatemala and who are trying to come across the Texas border to find his sister who is in Dallas. And so, you know, recently there was this huge flux of these unaccompanied minors that were coming across the border into Texas to escape this gang warfare and stuff that was happening in Central America. And so this is a story about one of those boys and this girl who was a neighbor of his who he kind of sweeps off, and they ride the top of this train called La Bestia to get across into Texas, and it's just about what it's like to be 12 and undocumented, and how maybe America is not, you know, the streets are not paved with gold, and how to come to terms with that, and it's, I don't know, it's about family.
Great. When is that slated?
This is going to be spring 2017.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Wow. Well, you've got, my word, you're busy.
Yeah,
that's great. Busy. Congratulations, though. I mean, that's a good kind of busy.
Yeah, it's great. It really is. Everything is so different that it is.
I was just going to say, look at the way you hop around with all of these topics. It's amazing.
Yeah, it keeps my brain spry.
Well, there you go. I like you're even giving me a little bit of a draw. I'm thinking about Red Moon Rising. Keeps my brain spry. It was a pleasure catching up with you again and getting to talk about House Arrest and getting to talk about Timothy. Thank you for sharing with us about your son as well and about just this experience and everything. You're a person I really admire a lot, and it's a pleasure always to get to talk to you.
Well, it was wonderful to talk to you again, and I really appreciate you having me and this book, I tell you what, once this book comes out, it's been quite a journey. It'll be quite a thing on the release day for House Arrest.
Oh, well, I'm looking forward to releasing this and celebrating that with you. Let's continue talking about celebrations by going onto the kickball field and thinking about who you want around you. This has become more and more fun since I've last talked to you. The more guests I have, the more I think an awareness of this question has started to become a thing, which means that there's like sometimes a lot of thought given to this that even surprises me, but just I keep hearing names that make me, the word is not nostalgic, but that's the feeling I feel like I'm having for this game that hasn't happened or probably cannot ever possibly really happen on the scale that we're talking, but the connectedness I keep feeling through this question. Of course, I'm excited to ask you again. So I'm assembling an all-star Kidlit Dream Team kickball tournament, and I would love to know, Carrie-Anne, what one more person you would want on your team, alive or past, from the Kidlit world, and why?
So this time I'm going to choose Lizzie Boyd, who I know has done this podcast before. Lizzie is not only a fantastic picture book illustrator, she's a hilarious and wonderful person. And I also am pretty sure she's not going to be offended when I say that she is probably as athletically inclined as I am.
Well worded.
So that Lizzie and I would have, you know, our elbows linked and be kind of standing back in the, I don't even know what you call it, right field, like in baseball. he's sort of out in the back together. And last time I said E.B. White because I thought that he and I could be standing in the back, like, you know, silently making fun of everyone. And I think that Lizzie would be great to join that team with us, me and Lizzie Boyd and E.B. White.
Well, I appreciate even more so that you are actually putting yourself onto the field. That's a good thing, too. Who knows what the result's going to be, but put me somewhere in the field where the ball's not going to come over to me too much so I can just have fun with my friend.
Exactly. We'll stand back there. We'll wait for the ball. It may roll by. One of us will decide to pick it up, but we will have a fantastic time standing back there, potentially drinking margaritas.
I love it. So I take it then, obviously, you've had the chance to meet Lizzie once or twice.
Yes, Lizzie and I have we've had some good times.
Oh, that is awesome. She's good people for sure. And cool that you're Chronicle buddies, too.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for coming on again. Congratulations about House Arrest releasing and all the ways it's going to connect with people. I just know it is. I can't wait to be checking up with you again and seeing what it's like to have this book in front of kids in schools and just the way you're working with them. So thanks again, Carrie-Anne.
Thank you so much, Matthew.
Let's Get Busy is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland, and by All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the books at allthewonders.com. Our theme music is by Blue Ducks. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referenced. Listeners, there are a ton of great episodes of Let's Get Busy archived and waiting for you at lgbpodcast.blogspot.com. And if this episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment on the blog or rate Let's Get Busy on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that is a very good thing indeed. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's Koko Sleep, and I'll see you there.